Shrink Wrap Radio number 856, UK writer Tim Lott reflects on Alan Watts, mental health, and consciousness.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My London associate and blogger, Isabella Clark, steps in to conduct yet another interview. I really treasure Issy, and I hope you do too. She's an Oxford grad and a professional broadcaster. She reads widely in areas I don't cover. Consequently, she brings us high-quality guests I would not have known about. Now, here's Issy with her latest find.
Hi, this is Issy Clark. My interviewee this time is a novelist, and I'm not interviewing him because his novels specifically address psychotherapy, but because of his philosophy of life. I hope this will become clearer in the conversation that follows, but I'll try to set it up here. Tim Lott is an English author. He's written a memoir which recounts his mother's suicide and his own breakdown, as well as 10 novels. I had read one of them, Rumours of a Hurricane, when it came out and thought it excellent. So when I saw Tim's name on an Eon article, I had a read. The piece was about Alan Watts and explains how an understanding of Zen through the lens of Watts impacted Tim's life. What fascinated me was the importance, for some of us at any rate, of working towards our own philosophy of life. I wanted to talk to him to see how much it mattered to him to know what to make of this wild and wonderful life. So, this isn't a psychologist, a therapist, a medic, or a coach, but I think there's a lot to ruminate over and consider that's relevant to the core themes of Shrink Wrap Radio. Oh, and there's a tiny bit of fruity language in there as well. It might be the first time there's been an E for explicit on this podcast, but honestly, it's only 3 words, so don't be put off. Now, here's the interview. Tim Lott, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
So we're going to be talking primarily about your experiences of Zen meditation or the Zen philosophy, really, particularly in the flavour of Alan Watts. But I wanted to start by getting a sense of why it formed such an important part of your life at a particular time. So I think we need to go through a little bit of your biography and understand what you felt you needed when you became particularly engaged with his thinking.
Okay, well, I didn't discover Alan Watts until I was in my 30s. At that point, I had a nervous breakdown, which I had when I was in my early 30s. Subsequently, I wrote a memoir about that breakdown, not purely about that. It was also about my mother and growing up as a working class boy in London and class, as well as mental illness. But as part of that journey, I became friends in my researches with a woman called Dorothy Rowe, seems to be largely forgotten nowadays, but was a wonderful, wise woman, and we became close friends. And she pointed me in the direction of Alan Watts. Dorothy Rowe, who some people might have heard of, was actually a kind of Buddhist, though she was kind of horrified to be described as such because, you know, as she used to say herself, I don't go around sticking gold flakes on the Buddha. I mean, she's just had a Buddhistic philosophy of life. And I didn't really understand what she meant by that. But she told me to go and read Alan Watts. And then I did start reading him, and I sort of became, I don't know if obsessed is, that's a bit of a sort of mental health word, isn't it? But I became fascinated by Alan Watts, and I thought he had all the answers, really, to things that had troubled me ever since I was a teenager. And he explained so much about being alive on this planet, which for me had been a torturous puzzle. And nobody seemed to talk about the things that bothered me. What bothered me, question mark? Well, I suppose it was that nothing seemed to make any sense, was what bothered me. And yet everybody walked around as if it did. And everyone sort of seemed absolutely sure of themselves and what they knew and what they thought. Whereas I just used to think, well, how can you be so sure? You know, and everybody thinks everything different. So what makes you think you're right? And that's always been something that's tormented me. It's like, who gives me the pride of the capital P to say I'm right? So Alan Watts, after I had my breakdown, which was connected in a way with not having a sense of place or a philosophy to fall back on in some ways, because I was a classic product of modernity, I suppose, uprooted, atomistic, pleasure-seeking, lost in the moment, not having any particular personal philosophy, not religious, just drifting from one moment to the next and sort of blundering around, really. And I didn't like that feeling. I wanted a feeling of some kind of philosophy that I could believe in, or at least not find ridiculous. And most philosophies I found fairly incoherent, I suppose, and certainly religions. So anyway, on reading Alan Watts, Alan Watts, if I can, you know, it came along at the end of quite a fair list of people who I had been reading to try and get a sense of what was going on in my own mind and in the world.
Who else did you read?
Rollo May. I read The Existential Psychologist, mm-hmm. Joseph Campbell, Jung. I was very fascinated. I'm a storyteller. I'm a novelist by trade. So, you know, I'm very interested in stories. And therefore, I couldn't help but be fascinated by the Joseph Campbell interpretation of storytelling and the mythic structures that were embedded in all human cultures. And that struck me as fascinating. Jung and Joseph Campbell, I listened to this TV series called The Power of Myth that was shown on American TV when I was living in America for a few months. And that was interviews with Joseph Campbell. That was terrific. That really excited me. And every now and again, you know, I come across a thinker that really speaks to me. Not that often. You know, and most thinkers I go, I sort of, you know, kind of get it, but I don't really get it. Alan Watts seemed to tick all the boxes and still does. I think he's a remarkable figure and an amazing man. And I wish I'd met him. You know, I'm very grateful to him because what I liked about Alan Watts, I don't know, we haven't ever talked about Alan Watts and who he was. But what I loved about him was that he was a kind of, he was very English in that, and by that I meant he had a sense of humour about himself, unlike most gurus.
Yeah, definitely.
He had a wonderful laugh. He liked things of the flesh, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll was all ticks for, as far as he was concerned. He was, you know, as far away from being ascetic as you could imagine. And he was just a very, and he was very flawed. He was a drunk, He was, you know, he was a lousy father. He was married three times to other drunks. I mean, you know, he was really he was not what you would call a saintly figure. And that attracted to me to him even more, because as he often said, you know, you should never, there's nothing more dangerous than a saint, which I kind of agree with, really. Mm. You know, I like flawed individuals, because I think, because we're all flawed, and anybody who pretends they're not has got their head screwed on wrong, you know, and I do think this sort of acceptance of our central crooked timber is one of the things that I find very reassuring about Alan Watts. He's very forgiving in his philosophy. He's very accepting of who we are, you know, and he's not in any way pious or moralistic. And, you know, he celebrates life and joy. And, you know, that's what I call a philosopher, not sort of, you know, not Kierkegaard or Plato sitting there, you know, philosophizing themselves to death. I mean, you know, just people who have some joie de vivre, which he absolutely did.
Just before we go into his thinking and the things that particularly inspired you, I hope you don't mind, but in an article you wrote for The Guardian, you do go through the difficulties of your life, and they were not inconsiderable. I mean, your mother's death by suicide, being bullied as a child. I mean, they're challenging things for anyone to deal with. And at the particular time of your breakdown, I think in the article you mentioned that three people very close to you had recently died as well. So this was a sort of a cataclysmic time on top of a life that had already had sufficient hardship, really.
I suppose so. I mean, I wouldn't overstress that. I mean, it depends on how you look at it, doesn't it? I mean, you know, I had loving parents. I had a stable home. Mm. I was enough food on the table. I was bored out of my mind. But I mean, you know, I wasn't actually, when I read about some of the things that children go through when they're growing up, I mean, I think I was fairly lucky. I mean, yeah, my big brother was a bit of a heifer towards me, though I'm very close to him now and I love him very much. But at that time, we really didn't get on at all. And I was born with cancer, and that was not good. And I was operated on as a 3-day-old baby without anaesthetic, as far as I can make out.
Yeah, they would have then. Yeah, it would have been without anaesthetic.
So
yeah.
God knows what had effect that had on me. But, you know, shit happens to everybody. I'm not trying to downplay it, but I mean, I'm simply saying that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I didn't have a sort of spectacularly, well, you know, as I say, I read stories about people who are used by their grandfathers and buggered by the scoutmaster or whatever. I mean, I didn't have any of that really going on, which in some ways made being depressed worse, because I didn't really have any obvious reason to be depressed at any point. I mean, as things went, I was okay. And I didn't, you know, have anything particularly to complain about.
I think I can empathise with that, because I would sort of say, I mean, I had some things that were wrong and hard and very challenging, and other things that were, you know, really very positive in my upbringing, and, you know, on the whole, taken in the great scheme of things, hugely fortunate. And when I have suffered periods of depression, that has been one of the worst things, is not only am I depressed, but I feel like a weak failure as well, because yeah. there isn't really
no,
this.
That's one of the hellish things about depression. You often don't have anything in particular to be depressed about. You know, you're just depressed. Mm. And so everyone goes, well, what are you so miserable about? You know, you've got things pretty sweet. Thanks a lot. You know, I mean, so that doesn't feel good, you know, because you don't feel you've got any rights to feel unhappy, and yet you do. You feel desperately miserable.
How did it impact your writing? Because you wrote, I think, first the memoir, and then subsequently you've been writing novels. How did the periods of of either depression or of the positive feelings, which we'll get to after you'd really fully embraced the Alan Watts ideas, how did that impact your creativity?
Well, all I can say about that is that depression is not good for creativity. I mean, it destroys creativity. It was only when I recovered from depression I could start being creative, because I had the spare energy. You know, when you're depressed, all your energy goes into being depressed. There's nothing left over, or defending yourself against whatever you're defending yourself against. So on the one hand, there's no sense, in which depression helped me to be a creative person. On the other hand, being a creative person, particularly as a writer, and I read a statistic recently that, I mean, there's a often repeated trope about creative people that they go crazy more often than other people, or suffer depression more than other people. Apparently this isn't true. Except in the case of writers. And novelists who are, and I understand why, you know, it's an extraordinarily isolated, introverted, cut off kind of world in which you tend to feel quite separate from other people. You kind of are slightly outside of everything else, and it's quite isolating. And, you know, after all, you have to spend a long time in a room by yourself, grappling with something you don't know what to call. Grappling to find something you don't know what you're looking for. I mean, it's very, very challenging job. I mean, I teach creative writing on Substack, and you know, one of the things I try and press on my students is, you know, don't mistake this for, you know, a harmless hobby. I mean, trying to write anything serious or serious with serious intent doesn't have to be serious. I mean, I try and be funny in my novels if I can be, but you know, is no joke. I mean, it's a attempt to master imaginatively the world, and that's something most of us don't ever do because we're too busy putting food on the table, going to work, planning our holiday, and building the kitchen extension. Novelists just sit there thinking, what the hell's going on? You know, it's a bit like being a philosopher, only we're not quite as clever as philosophers. But I like to think we're sometimes wiser.
I wondered, this is somewhat tangential, but just thinking about it, I've done some creative writing courses and written some, you know, fairly dreadful poetry and really dreadful prose. But one long piece that I wrote, and I remember sort of I remember two things. One, that it did seem to have its own guiding principle of what happened, that there, and when it wasn't happening, I couldn't make it. It guided itself. But the other thing about it being so all encompassing, that all of the time this world and these characters were, you know, around me. And I wonder, you know, if you're actually quite good at it, and it is really your job, not just something you're doing to, you know, as a exploration, if that sort of changes your experience of kind of consciousness and day-to-day living in some sense, because you're almost inhabiting two worlds simultaneously.
Maybe. I mean, when I read back some of my novels, which I rarely do, but occasionally I have to, because, well, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, some TV company wanted to buy the rights to one of my novels, and I couldn't remember the hell what the novel was about. So I had to go back and read it again. And on the occasions I've done it, I think, whoever's written this novel is much cleverer than I am. You know, and I genuinely feel that, you know, that's almost someone else writes the novels, that they are of a, you know, they are of a caliber that is quite beyond my everyday communication and intellectual skills. And it's almost like entering a trance state.
Yeah, a demon. It's like a demon. Was it Plato or Socrates? One of them talks about the demon, having the demon as, and some people translate it as kind of soul or something. But it makes me think of that.
Daemon, I think. Absolutely. I mean, it's you know, the more I live and write and think, the less of a materialist I am. You know, and I believe in demons, you know, I believe in gods and demons, and I believe in a spiritual universe without a doubt. You know, I'm no longer what I was most of my life, which was like, if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. Which struck me as one of those stupid precepts for life as I can possibly imagine. I mean, the whole scientific mindset is absurd as far as I because you're told that it's like the only way of thinking and everything else is woo-woo. Actually, you know, the scientific way of thinking is unbelievably narrow-minded. So I've become, you know, as I say, I'm not a materialist. I believe in gods and demons. I believe that those demons and gods are within you and within your unconscious. And what we call it, the unconscious, but it used to be called God. It used to be called the gods. You can't deny it. You know, if you close your eyes, there are these little images and words are popping into your head. Where the hell do they come from? I don't know. You know, nobody knows. And suddenly this consciousness is here. What is this consciousness? So again, science has got no idea what the hell consciousness is. They like to play it, pretend they do. They've got no idea what consciousness is. And, you know, so my starting point for everything is I am conscious. And I am here. And everything else follows from that. I think it's called phenomenology. But I think it's the idea that the most fundamental form of reality is the fact that you're conscious. And that is not a material thing. Mm. Thinking, imagining is not a material process. There's a wonderful book called The Mark by Maurice Nicol, in which he talks about the life is interaction between the visible and invisible. And what we don't, or what we forget or don't realize, is that human beings are invisible. They are completely invisible. You know, of course, I can see your eyes and flesh and face, but yourself is entirely invisible to me. It's within your consciousness. You are an invisible person, and I am an invisible person. Well, the fact that we are lunking around these pieces of flesh is neither here nor there. We are fundamental. Everything is an interaction between the visible world and the invisible world. And the invisible world is absolutely as real as the visible world. It's absolute, if not more real, than the bookshelves behind you or the table in front of you. It's real. It's not some kind of, as the materialist would have it, some weird bit of steam that's let off as a byproduct of
epiphenomenalism.
The electrochemical processes. I mean, that's pathetic.
We could foray down this rabbit hole quite a long time, because I agree with so much, and also would like to sort of ask you about some other things, but it takes us away from the main subject of this. So if there's time at the end, we'll see if we can get back to consciousness, because it's something that's been discussed on this podcast quite a bit over the last month. But let's go back to Alan Watts and his particular flavor of Zen. And one of the things that you wrote in the article was his view of life having no intrinsic meaning any more than a piece of music has an intrinsic point. Life was, in Zen parlance, yugen, a kind of elevated purposelessness. How did that, was that a consolation for you in feeling, oh, well, it doesn't mean anything? Or did it have some sort of a deeper significance in bringing a kind of meaning to meaninglessness?
Yeah, I mean, let me be completely clear. I don't think life is meaningless. What I think is that we don't know what the meaning is.
Okay.
And I think that the idea, and to use the phrase precisely, the kind of elevated meaninglessness, it's not just, you know, oh, nothing means anything. Again, that's plainly absurd. Of course, things mean things. You know, everything means something. If I, you know, prod you in the throat, that means that, you know, you're going to be very annoyed with me. I mean, you know, that we're surrounded by meanings of love, anger, hate, desire, the gods within us, if you like. Meaning is everywhere. It's unavoidable. So, I, you know, the traditional religious attitude was, you know, everything is meaningful. We've now moved to this modern view that nothing has any meaning. And I think, you know, the ancients are far more correct than we are. But what that meaning is inexpressible. And that's something also religious and spiritual teachers have really been saying since the beginning. You know, the Taoists say, you know, the Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao. And even, you know, I believe that's true of Christianity too. You know, that really we cannot say what it is that of which life comprises or means, but that doesn't mean it doesn't mean anything and it doesn't comprise anything. It's just that our language and perceptions are not up to it, basically. You know, if I try, I mean, I spent my whole life trying to work out what life means. And if you said to me, well, what does it mean then, Tim? You know, I mean, it's just like, I don't know. You know, what am I going to tell you? I mean, what it means, go and read my 10 novels. That's what it means. You know, that will start you off. You know, go and look at this poem. That'll give you a clue. But it's all clues. It's all hints. But you can't, in this very sort of mechanistic way, go, well, it means A this, B this, C this, and D this. That's part of the crazy mindset that we've got ourselves into.
It sounds like you're saying, in some sense, it's kind of emergent, but also going back to phenomenology, experiential. I was listening to an interview with Aboriginal political scientist Mary Graham last night, and she was talking about the dreaming, and she was saying that one person, the one white fella, had described the dreaming. And he had described it in a way of what it was like. And she appreciated that description. And somebody else had tried to make a representation of it as what it is. And she could see that as a kind of reified thing. But what it was like is something that's entirely different from the reified representation, however accurate that representation may be.
Well, when you say reified, can you just, what do you mean by that?
Something that's made into an object that can be looked at and analysed and
like ceremonies and rituals?
No, that he had described it as if to turn it into the thing that is analysed rather than an experience.
Oh, yes.
Or an emergent, rather than what it's like to be in that state. Yeah. And if you're, the meaning of that state is what it's like to be in that state, not something that you could describe externally. So you could describe externally the sort of the carapace of dreaming, but dreaming incorporates, this emergent experiential lived sense, lived and emotional and embodied qualities that you just couldn't represent.
No, and that sort of, Why I asked about ritual and ceremony is because, in a way, ritual and ceremony and religious ceremony are all attempts to get at that thing that we can't speak words for. But they, you know, they're very moving, these ceremonies, but we don't know why, you know, because words are a very, and this is one of the things Alan Watts writes about, you know, he says that words are an incredibly limited and sketchy, what's the word, not lateral exactly, but, you know, very one-dimensional way of describing experience. And we've become so obsessed with the way we symbolize meaning through words, as philosophers have, you know, words are incredibly inadequate. I'm a writer, but, you know, God knows, words are so inadequate for explaining what is taking place at any time. You know, reality is way beyond speaking. You know, we can sort of hint at it, but an image in a film might make a massive impact on us, but we might not be able to say why. A man nailed to a cross might have a huge amount of impact on us, but we may not be able to say why. And yet, you know, that image has taken the Western world through 2,000 years. You know, and somehow that image of the cross and the man nailed, the crucifixion, has had this incredible, it's enough to build 10,000 churches. What does it mean? What the hell are all those churches doing there? You know, it's a very peculiar thing. And I think life is very mysterious.
And so was it the sense that reading Watts allowed you to see that, to be more comfortable with that kind of esoteric, indescribable meaning of life, rather than always seeking a kind of understanding, a symbolic understanding that you could sort of put your finger on or aim towards?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he weaned me off of sort of logical positivism or rationalism. You know, he weaned me away from, he was one, there others came after us, but he weaned me away from the idea. You know, he used to talk about pickles and goo. Have you heard about this?
Yes.
Prickly,
I like that.
People and gooey people, you know, and the prickly people go, well, no, the world is exactly like this. And outside of this, there's nothing whatsoever. And the gooey people go, oh, I don't know, man, it's kind of, you know, I don't know, it's kind of weird. And he says, you know, the world isn't prickles or goo, it's prickly goo. You know, it's this sort of weird mixture. And you know, we're constantly trying to nail what I got out of Watts primarily is like I was trying to nail the world down in my mind. And it wasn't until I read Watts I understood you cannot nail the world down, because it's like trying to nail water down. You know, life is not quantifiable. It is not describable. It is not what we speak about. The map is not the territory. You know, and he's very good on it, on really explaining how, and this is a Zen understanding, you know, that life is, I mean, this is obviously part of Zen discipline, is to try and experience the world without words or concepts, to say, you know, to sit in a room and just, this is it, this is the experience, and I'm not going to comment on it, and I'm not going to form words about it, I'm not even going to form images about it, I'm just going to experience it. And that's being. And that was very powerful for me, the idea that, you know, what reality was could not actually be nailed down. That was one thing. And also, he's wonderful. He's one of my favorite books of his is The Wisdom of Insecurity. And you know, which is got me to understand that there is no security. The whole idea of security is ridiculous. You know, the metaphor he uses, which I think is rather wonderful, is, you know, seeking security in life is like, he said, well, you're pushed off a cliff when you're born, and holding onto a rock when you're falling is not going to make you any more secure. You know? And I thought, that's absolutely true. You know, there's no security and you're going to die. You know, basically, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going on. You don't know who you are. You don't know who the other person is. You haven't got a clue about anything, and you're going to die. That's your life. And so what are you going to do with that? You know, and you know, it is funny, but it's also terrifying. And people, in an attempt to deny the sheer intractability, the unknowability of things, devise patterns, pages, if you like, within which they live.
Yeah.
Because they can't bear the sheer unknowability and uncertainty of things. And what Watts taught me to try and do, though he was very against trying, Watts, he didn't believe in trying, he believed in allowing things to happen. You know, all this, sort of, I'm going to do it. No, he was very against that. The idea that you can, I forgot what I was going to say. It was probably very profound.
It was going to be hugely profound.
It really was, but it's gone. But that's that's uncertainty for you.
Oh, it really helps you too. We were on insecurity. Maybe this will sort of trigger.
Insecurity. We were about insecurity. Yes. And the idea that, you know, that you could somehow make yourself secure by clinging to a creed or a philosophy or a country or a religion or a social group. These will all give you a false sense of security, but there's no real security.
And you said, you were saying that it's also terribly frightening, and we try to sort of bulwark ourselves against the fear by all of these different methods, and ultimately all of those different methods are no use.
Well, they can be useful if you can get away with it, you know, but the trouble is sooner or later reality has a habit of sneaking up behind you and whacking you over the head, you know, and then what do you do? I think a lot of people get away with all kinds of silly belief systems, you know, and sometimes, perhaps quite often, it carries them through life. You know, I can't do that. No. I mean, perhaps I wish I could, but I can't. I find there's something about my mind that is always going, I don't know, that doesn't really make sense. You know, and that's not a very comfortable, it's not a very comfortable thing for other people to be around. I mean, I lost a lot of friends, not by being mean to them, by just going, I don't know why you believe that, you know, or I don't know why you think that. Why do you think that? And that is enough for some of them to absolutely freak out, you know, because they've actually never thought about it, you know, and most people's beliefs are picked up like little motes of fluff on your jumper when you're walking past a static cone. You know, we sold this myth that we're independent individuals, but we're not. You know, we're put together by society, by history, by media, by advertising, by a family. You know, to think independently, which I suppose has always been my goal, is a very hard goal, because, you know, you are not only are you made out of other people and other things and other processes, but also thinking for yourself, although it's much advertised as a good thing. In fact, most people don't like it. You know, they don't like being around people who think for themselves, actually. They like to think they do, but they don't. They like people who think for themselves within a certain very small spectrum of the agreed assumptions. You know, I live in a very, very stereotypical liberal middle class area of Northwest London, you know, and everybody believes exactly the same thing as far as I can make out, you know, and they all think they're very individual and brilliant, and they're clever people, they're not fools, but actually, you know, if you sort of say to them, well, I don't know, maybe open borders isn't a great idea. You know, I mean, you can have like a hysterical fury coming at you. You know, it's like, whatever. You know, the fact is there is a certain, it's nothing about it being independent, free thinking. They are just as tribal as a West Ham supporter, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I mean, there's no difference. And if you raise your voice against the mob, and there are clever mobs as well as dumb mobs, you know, you're not going to make yourselves very popular. That's why I have no friends and do interviews like this, you know, just to have someone to talk to for a few.
Oh, well, you know, it's nice for me to have someone to talk to. I mean, I have a few friends, but, you know, not that many. It kind of aligns with one of the other things that I'd drawn out of the article that, you said, you wrote that Watt saw his job via Zen philosophy to teach you to think clearly so that you could see through conventional thinking, as you're saying, to a place where your mind could be at peace inside a culture that could have been designed to generate anxiety. So do you feel, I mean, is your mind, it sounds as if your mind was at peace when you went through this initial period with Watt. Because you do say in that article that you felt that you experienced a state of Sartori for enlightenment for for pretty much a year, and then that sort of faded away. So can you give us a sort of sense of that sort of narrative arc?
Well, it's hard to say. All I can say is that I feel it very much at the moment. I feel very much in the flow. I don't worry about anything. I sleep well. I wake up feeling fine. I'm not, you know, emotionally agitated by anything. I feel I take things in my stride. So that's quite close to that, you know, the ideal state. But, you know, a couple of months ago, I felt very differently. I felt very upset and about something personal. And I was not feeling good. And I didn't feel at ease. And I didn't feel, what should we say, equilibrium. Nothing dangerous. Nothing, you know, that would approach depression or anxiety. But I just didn't feel at ease in the world. And I have a very good, actually a Zen psychotherapist, who is a really terrific guy, who has helped me enormously over the last 10 years. And he had a very simple solution, which I have tried before, but, you know, it actually does work. He just said, well, you know, you should try meditating. I thought, yeah, all right. I used to meditate and I stopped. I started meditating again, and Bob's your uncle. I've been fine ever since. You know, I mean, just by sitting still for, you know, twice a day, 20 minutes has done wonders for me. So, you know, it's a slightly banal prescription. But along with a lot of other things, meditation, therapy, you know, can all, reading the right books, can all help. Just lately I felt in a very good place. And on top of being, you know, I don't know if I've mentioned this, or you've mentioned it, or my name has mentioned it, but I also was diagnosed with ADHD about 7-8 years ago. And that really did explain a lot about my life and the way the depressions I suffered and the way I lived my life and the mistakes I'd made in my life. Because, you know, I kind of had this little motor running inside me all the time, but it was just very hard to be still. I was always, you know, mentally active. And I've learnt, you know, that meditation is one of the ways you can help compensate for ADHD. Yeah.
Two things there. In fact, I might have just forgotten one of them, but one of the things, oh, you know, yes, in your article, you did say that you credited the ADHD with leading to some disastrous media appearances. And so I was thinking to myself, well, I wonder what's going to happen here. But the other thing was, I noticed in the Eon article, which we will link to in the show notes, that you wrote that that Alan Watts dismissed Zazen, dismissed the sort of sitting. So at the time, right back in your initial exploration of him, did you presumably didn't meditate then?
Yeah, a bit, but I mean, it's not that Alan Watts was against meditation. He just was against Zazen, you know, which he called the aching back school of Zen, which is like the more you can make your back ache, the better, the more spiritually elevated you are. And his answer to that is, well, you know, a cat sits until he's bored and then gets up and walks away. And, you know, the point about meditation, he says, and he's right, is it's not meant to be a task. You know, it's meant to be a pleasant experience. You know, people go, I've got to go and meditate. You know, and you see these sort of things that, you know, meditate for higher productivity. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of missing the point. The point of meditation is that it has no point, you know, and until you sort of understand how to live with pointlessness, that's what meditation's there for, is to make you think there's nothing wrong with just sitting here. I'm just sitting here. Okay? Got nothing else to say. You know, and that's... and in this culture we live in which we are constantly urged to go and do things, ideally as part of a group, to be able to say, I'm just sitting here, you know, is quite a powerful thing, I think. So no, Watts was not anti-meditation. He just didn't make a fetish of it.
I see.
He made quite a few videos, I think, about meditation and how to meditate, which I suspect he made for money as much as anything else. But I feel the same, you know. I meditate when I feel like meditating.
At the moment, I feel like meditating, so I'm meditating twice a day. But I probably won't. I'll probably stop again. It's not like I'm saying you must meditate. You know, none of that. None of these sort of, you know, cast iron principles hold water for very long. But I have found meditation helpful.
You mentioned earlier about the sort of scientific method having this kind of negative impact on the way that we think. And this idea of sort of pointlessness seems to me to be that kind of elevated sort of pointlessness without the meaninglessness. It seems to be kind of aligned with this idea of sort of imprecision, of ambiguity, of both and rather than, you know, or. I liked that one of the points that you brought out was what affirmation of the essential connectedness of things. And you write, we live in an imprecise world. Nature is extraordinarily vague. Science promotes the idea of hard, clear, brute facts, but some facts are soft. That gets back to the prickly and the gooey, I guess. A cutting up attitude to life gives us dead knowledge, not live knowledge. And I like that idea of live knowledge. And I think that, you know, for a writer as well, live knowledge surely must be a lot more fruitful to consider than dead knowledge.
Well, to be knowledge, it has to be live. You know, I mean, the moment you grasp it, it is dead, you know, in a strange way. I mean, this is one of those things I think is quite hard to describe, but... and you have to get into epistemological discussions about, you know, what it means to know things, which I'm not qualified to do. But I think when I think of times in my life when I've known things at some very deep level, it's definitely not I know that E equals MC squared. You know, perhaps that's a kind of sort of deep knowledge. It's some kind of connection with your unconscious mind again, which again, I would not hesitate to also call God. You know, I mean, I don't believe in a Christian God, but I'm definitely a deist. I mean, I definitely think we are surrounded within and without by something. You know, and I don't know what to call it, but it's there. Of course it's there. It's within me and it's within you and it's within everything else. I have no doubt about that anymore. So that's, I suppose, what I mean by living knowledge. And knowledge is something you kind of have to be, you don't go out and find it. You have to kind of be receptive to it, I think. Yes, that's the word. Receptive to it.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. When considering the, because I think, you know, reading through Alan Watts's books and looking at the recordings of all those different lectures and so forth that are on YouTube, and there is a vast treasure trove of that on YouTube. When you compare that with the impact of having therapy and the impact, I think, that you mentioned in the article, medication as well. Do you think they all three are equally valuable to you, or valuable in different ways for different aspects of, you know, of living in this difficult world?
Therapy, medication, and Alan Watts.
Yeah.
Three things.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, and meditation, I suppose. Meditation, medication.
Yeah, meditation, medication. Yeah, medication. Well, you put your finger on it, and they're all useful in their different ways. I mean, I think they're all valuable. You know, trying to find your way through all the possible ways of thinking about the world is very hard, because, you know, who the hell is Alan Watts? Nobody knows who he is. This, to me, is this spiritual genius. But most people haven't got a clue. You know, ask 100 people in the street where Alan Watts is, they haven't got a clue. You know, I mean, even amongst intellectuals, so-called, most people don't know who Alan Watts is. You know, it's quite a esoteric niche piece of knowledge, you might say. And this is always the surprising thing to me, because, you know, these quite marginal figures, to me, are very powerful. Dorothy Rowe, another one who's, you know, not really known by anybody, not taken notice of. It's not the big names. I mean, Freud, you know, was obviously a genius. Jung, I think, more so. And I've been reading a very good book of Jung's pretty impenetrable, but I've been reading a book of his speeches and essays, and that's really good, and that helps.
Which one's that?
It is called Jung Speaks.
Oh.
And it's all his interviews, all his public lectures, it's quite a rare book. I think I had to pay 30 quid or something, 40 quid maybe from America for it. But it's the only book I've read that really has a satisfactory way of explaining what he was going on about, which wasn't always very clear. And he certainly impresses me. And of course, you know, he is more like a household name. But, you know, Joseph Campbell is somebody who is known more now because of his impact on storytelling. I would have to say, controversially, I'm a big fan of early Jordan Peterson. I'm telling you, when Dulally, I think his early stuff was quite brilliant. And I've been watching it again recently. His Maps of Meaning lectures are quite superb, you know. And he's to me one of the most important living thinker, but who's somehow shot himself in the foot by getting involved in these ridiculous cultural arguments, you know, and they've torn him to pieces, I think.
And I think he's reacted to it by sort of pushing himself further in one direction than he would naturally have gone.
Very badly, I think. I'm not surprised. I mean, my God, he came in for a sort of beating, you know. And I suppose it was what I said earlier is that people who speak their own mind, even if they're as charismatic and clever as Jordan Peterson, do not make themselves popular, you know. And he was, I mean, of course, he had many, many acolytes, of which I was one. And I met him many times and had conversations with him many times and found him a remarkable man. But it's so sad to watch him being, as it were, possessed by demons, if you like, is how he would put it, I think. I mean, I remember asking him in an early interview, saying, well, aren't you worried that all this fame and attention is going to ruin you? And he said, well, yes, I'm very aware. I'm very careful. You know, I know how this could go to your head. You know, now look where we are, the sort of ranting lunatic on YouTube channels. I mean, it's so sad because I think he's become exactly the person all his detractors said he was. And I think he was an incredible thinker, you know, and he's lost his way. And you know, he was kind of crucified, I think, and unfairly, I think, very unfairly. But he's ended up in this place of sort of, you know, the hall of villains to the liberal sensibility of some corners. And, you know, we're in an era of groupthink, and people like Jordan Peterson don't go down very well. But, you know, when I listen to him now, which I don't, but when I have, I think, well, I can see your point. I'm not talking his point. I mean, the people who hate him, you know, because I think he is a dick, you know, just like, and then I think, but he's not. He's a really smart guy who actually taught me a lot, particularly about storytelling, actually. As I say, I'm a novelist, so his understanding of storytelling is incredibly powerful. But also the idea that, you know, it's the fundamental question. How do we make meaning of the world? Why do we believe what we believe? You know, and that's an incredibly crucial question, because he starts off, I was rewatching the Maps of Meaning, and saying, well, he starts off, he started studying in the days of the Cold War, Russia versus America, and just all these nuclear weapons pointed at each other. And just thinking, what's going on here? Why are these ideas, you know, worth destroying the world for? You know, it's a good question. You know, it's a very good question. Mm. And that's really what he delves into, why we believe things with such passion, often without much reason. And ironically, that's what's brought him down. You know, a lot of people, that is ironic. Without much reason. You know, there you go. Anyway.
And what about Ian McGilchrist? I imagine that he might be of interest to you.
Oh yeah, I think he's brilliant. Yeah,
I mean, yes, yeah, he is. He is. He is fantastic. I was watching a conversation he had with a guy who I didn't know before, but that found fascinating, called Patrick Curry, who's written about enchantment. And you know, and enchantment and art is his recent book, where he's looking, I think, more at you know, paintings, and but he's got a couple of chapters on literature apparently, but that I think McGilchrist is absolutely fascinating. Really sort of speaks to me.
I agree, and you know, there are wise men out there, but with the, who knows who they are? I know who they are, perhaps.
Some of them.
Who they are. But most people haven't got a clue who they are. When asked who the most intelligent man in Britain was a few years ago, the wisest man in Britain, I think they came up with some, you know, it was Richard Dawkins or something, which is kind of hilarious.
I wouldn't have minded if it was David Attenborough.
No, but, you know, he's a scientist and, you know, he's nobody, including me, is not going to speak a word against David Attenborough. You know, he's not somebody who, probably given his years of biological training, there's only so many ways you can think about the world, you know, even if you're David Attenborough, you know, and I think the idea of thinking too far outside the box for someone who is trained in scientific rigor to such an extent is going to be a challenge. But I don't know. I don't know enough. But I'm a big admirer of his, of course. Who wouldn't be? But yeah, I mean, clearly a wise man. But like you said, Ian McGilchrist, walk down the street, ask 100 people who Ian McGilchrist is. No one's got a clue. Yeah. You know,
I think, you know, for someone of, well, it sounds as if for someone of your particular characteristics, and I think I sort of share a lot of it, that this idea of having a sense of, you know, what is the way I'm going to make sense of life. I mean, I don't particularly like the idea of having a sort of like a narrative arc to my own experience, in that, you know, I went through this dark night and that gave me these strengths, and then I picked up my Excalibur sword again. I mean, I'm not particularly into that sort of narrative view of therapy. But I do have a really strong searching, questing for having this idea of what you seem to have found by bringing together Alan Watts and your own thinking and the gods and demons, a view of, well, this is how I understand life. And yeah. I think that it seems to me that, you know, partly that's coming through Watts, and a lot of it through thinking, through meditation, through conversations with a Zen psychologist, through being in a calm enough place, assisted perhaps by medication, that, you know, that actually is the therapeutic tool. The therapeutic tool is like the emergent quality of all of those things, which comes together in a kind of life philosophy. Or am I just being too florid about that?
I don't know about Floyd, but I'm not quite sure what it is you're saying. All those things have their role, will be one way of putting it.
But don't they all come together to give you this sense of, this is my vision of life, as it were, and that itself is what's therapeutic.
Well, at least I have a vision of life. You know, what always bothered me is I didn't have a vision of
life. Yes.
You know, I didn't have any idea what was going on. You know, nothing anybody said made any sense to me. None of the thinkers I read had any impact on me. You know, I read books on Buddhism and thought, well, this is a load of rubbish. You know, I mean, because I was reading the wrong books, you know, because most people have got a complete misunderstanding of what Buddhism is, just as they've got a complete misunderstanding of what Zen is. you know, and it took me a long time to work out the philosophy behind these things, which usually get turned into religions of one kind or another. But to actually go to the root and understand, I'm not any great intellectual, you know, I need to find people like Watts who are capable of explaining to me, you know, these difficult ideas, you know, and I think that's a lifetime's job, is trying to track down, is trying to find the people who speak to your experience. And, you know, the people I have found, you know, be it Joseph Campbell, be it Jung, be it Alan Watts, be it Dorothy Rowe, be it Jordan Peterson, they're people who speak to my experience. And so I read them and I think, yes, that's the way it is, but no one else is saying this, you know, and that is incredibly powerful. And you sort of build layer by layer a sense of, shall we say, realistic awareness. Let's put it no more strongly than that.
And so if you were to, if we were sort of considering that quite a lot of the people who might be listening to this might be psychologists in training, or people with an interest in sort of therapy, is there anything that, you know, if you were speaking to psychologists, that you might say, well, you know, here's something that you can suggest to clients, or here's something that you can that might be useful for you to consider when dealing with clients out of all this experience of dealing with depression, dealing with ADHD, and forging a kind of independent path through it?
That's a really difficult question.
Yes, it was a really difficult question. I threw it at you right at the end.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm not a therapist, and I know a lot of therapists. And, you know, there's a huge amount of training involved in therapy to achieve just that, I suppose, professional training and so forth. I want to stick with this because it's a really good question. I wonder what I would say to a therapist. You know, all I can say is what I would say. I had several therapists before I settled on mine. And what I would say I love about him, is that he tells me nothing. He never gives me advice. He never tells me what things are or should be. He just asks me interesting questions. That's all he does. You know, and that interesting question might be, well, why do you think that? You know, or it might be, why do you feel so bad about that? You know, and really nothing more than that. But that's very powerful. You know, and if I had anything to say to therapists, you'd be humble, be very humble in front of a human being, because human beings are complex creatures. And if you think you know what the hell is going on inside another human being, check yourself. You know, you are on the same journey to try and understand the most mysterious of things, people. You know, and don't get it into your head because you're a therapist. You know, you have, any more than me as a novelist, you know, that I have some magnificent insight into what human beings are. They're a mystery, a deep, impenetrable mystery, which does not mean you cannot help them. You can. And I have sat down to dinner with half a dozen actually psychoanalysts, not psychotherapists. And interestingly and shockingly to me, none of them thought they were doing any good. And I said, well, why are you doing it then? There was a kind of like slight, you know, well, there was a long silence. It was like, you know, just like, it was like a joke amongst them that they were making all this money out of, but none of them really thought they were doing any good. You know, I just thought, well, stop fucking doing it then. You know, because you're just stealing from people. And if you can't think you're helping people, why do it? you know, you've got to be thinking. And I'm enormously grateful to my therapist. He helps me and has helped me, and there's no doubt about it. You know, and if you're a therapist and you don't think you're helping your clients, well, I would stop wasting both of your time.
And time being, I've already taken up more than an hour of your time. So unless there's anything else that you particularly wanted to say, we'll of course put contact details for your Substack and how people can find your writing blog, and also links to the two articles that we've been referencing. But is there anything else that you particularly wanted to say before we sign off?
Anything I want to say? See, I feel I've got a great opportunity here, and and yes, I'm going to flop it, because, you know, if you haven't got anything out of what I've already said, then there's nothing I can really add to it, I don't think. You know, make peace with uncertainty would be my motto. And death, of course. Okay. Easy enough.
No problem there then.
No problem then.
Tim Lott, thank you so much for being on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye now.
I hope you enjoyed hearing Tim Lott talk about how he has brought Zen teaching into his own vision, version, or view of what life is all about. He discussed complex and profound ideas so eloquently. Well, he is a writer, so I guess he should be good with words. What I was struggling to express at the end was the sense I have that through the use of various different tools, medication and meditation, Zen and one's own thinking, questioning and analysing, something new arises or emerges. Just as through a collection of processes, chemical, biological, electrical, life emerges. What I'm saying is, the thing we seek, or perhaps I should say, the thing I seek, a sense of satori or meaning or value, may arise only by engaging in not just therapy and not just reading, not just being in nature and not just yoga, but through the assimilation of a variety of practices. What I felt strongly was that so often we look for certainty and the one magic bullet. By accepting uncertainty and variety, maybe then what we always searched for can be found. I'll just read the end of the piece Tim wrote for the English newspaper The Guardian, which we'll link to in the show notes. It turns out that the main lesson I've learned is that not being sure is the essential condition of life. With that in mind, I'm looking forward to what happens next. Only I'm not, because looking forward is pointless. So is looking back. Because every time you do so, the picture changes. The past is no more fixed than the future. What I think about my life is my life. Until, of course, I think about it next time.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Morgan Adolfsen from Norway, clinical psychologist. I've been a long-time listener to both Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap Radio. Today, I'm so happy that I pressed the donate button. So from this day, I will regularly contribute to support your shows. And I really appreciate your work, Dave. So good luck. Thank you.
Thank you, clinical psychologist Morgan Adolfsen. They're in Norway. I appreciate that over the years you found value in both my Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel podcasts, and your commitment to becoming a regular donor. Thanks so much for your enthusiastic support and your encouragement of others out there to follow your sterling example. Once again, time to shrink wrap it up. Thanks again to my London colleague, Isabella Clark, for bringing us her thoughtful discussion with UK writer, Tim Lott, reflecting on Alan Watts, mental health, and consciousness. Next week, my guest will be Dr. Robert Okun, MD, a world-recognized expert on human rights for the mentally disabled. He's a clinical psychiatrist, professor emeritus at the University of California's San Francisco School of Medicine, and a former commissioner of mental health in both Vermont and Massachusetts, who spent 2 years on the streets meeting and photographing homeless individuals with mental illness. We'll be discussing the new edition of that groundbreaking book, Silent Voices. Until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourself, others, and our precious Earth.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.